Dermatology Snapshots, September 2023. Join the mailing list to receive this latest edition directly. admin@dermatologysnapshots.com. Paper 1. JAK inhibitors and the risk of malignancy. A meta-analysis across disease indications. Russell et al. Annals of the Rheumatic Disease. Why we chose this paper. Previous studies looking at malignancy risk in patients on JAK inhibitors have mainly focused on older patients with rheumatoid arthritis. This meta-analysis sought to explore risk across all disease indications, compared with TNF inhibitors, methotrexate and placebo. 62 randomised control trials, phase 2, 3 or 4, and 16 long-term extension studies were included. JAK inhibitors were prescribed for rheumatoid arthritis, psoriatic arthritis, psoriasis, axial spondyloarthritis, inflammatory bowel disease and atopic eczema. JAK inhibitors used comprised, in decreasing frequency, tofacitinib, baricitinib, upadacitinib, filgotinib and perfcitinib. There were 82,362 person years of exposure with the JAK inhibitors group. What were the main findings? Overall malignancy incidence rate was 1.26 per 100 person years. The incidence of all malignancies, including non-melanoma skin cancers, was not significantly different between the JAK inhibitors and placebo, or between the JAK inhibitors and methotrexate. Compared with TNF inhibitors, however, JAK inhibitors were associated with an increased risk of increased incidence of malignancy. The same pattern was seen if you only look at non-melanoma skin cancer risk. When you look at the rates compared to placebo, it could be said that JAK inhibitors are protective against malignancy, but is not as much as TNF inhibitors are. Limitations. Is it applicable? Study heterogeneity was low and most had low risk of bias. Cancer has a long latency period, so real-world longitudinal data will be most valuable in time. Authors acknowledge that one study, the oral surveillance trial, which compared tofacitinib with TNF inhibitors in patients with rheumatoid arthritis aged over 50 years, who had additional cardiovascular risk factors, swayed results. If left out of analysis, there remained higher cancer incidence with JAK inhibitors than TNF inhibitors, but it was no longer statistically significant. What's the take-home message? Longer observational studies are needed, but risk of malignancy is probably greater in patients on JAK inhibitors than TNF inhibitors, but not with people on methotrexate or placebo. Paper 2. Prognostic factors for long-term aesthetic outcome of infantile hemangiomas treated with beta blockers. Hermans et al. Acta Dermatovenereologica. Why we chose this paper. Previous research has shown that the type of beta blocker, propranolol/etanolol, does not impact long-term aesthetic outcome of infantile hemangioma. Studies using assessments by dermatologists show that superficial ulcerated infantile hemangiomas, infantile hemangiomas of the scalp and face, are high risk for poor aesthetic outcome. More information is needed for us to be able to guide parents, especially exploring the views of parents and children treated. Study aim and design. A retrospective cross-sectional two-centre study of 103 children treated with propranolol or etanolol for at least 6 months, where treatment was initiated before 1 year old. Long-term assessment using the Patient Observer Scar Assessment Scale and the Visual Analog Scale for children occurred after age 6. What were the main findings? Parents and dermatologists judged outcomes more negatively in cases of superficial infantile hemangioma, ulceration, older age at initiation, higher cumulative dose and shorter follow-up period. Surprisingly, children themselves felt head infantile hemangiomas had better aesthetic outcome than those elsewhere on the body. Telangiectasia was seen in 65%, fibrofatty tissue in nearly half, and atrophic scar tissue in 30%. Patterns of scarring varied between genders. Limitations, is it applicable? It is likely that higher cumulative dose association reflects the infantile hemangioma severity. Longer follow-up could be helpful in terms of offering reassurance to parents throughout the involution phase and enabling expectation management. What's the take-home message? Factors predicting worse aesthetic outcome can be shared with parents to guide expectations long-term. Referral pathways should be designed to enable early beta blocker initiation in suitable cases. Long-term sequelae, such as telangiectasia, are common despite beta blocker treatment. Close follow-up may help with perceived outcomes and enable early identification of those cases where laser or surgery may be beneficial. Paper 3. Topical steroid withdrawal. What do we know about this growing problem? Also called red skin syndrome and topical steroid addiction, we're all hearing more about this newly described disease. What can we learn from the medical literature about topical steroid withdrawal? There has been an almost 6 times increase in discussion of hashtag topical steroid withdrawal on the social media platform Instagram between 2020 and 2016. Prompted by numerous inquiries about, quote, steroid addiction syndrome, the National Eczema Association of the USA noted that this was not part of medical guidelines. The 2015 systematic review, N equals 34 studies included, described topical corticosteroid withdrawal syndrome as mainly affecting the face and genital area of women following long-term inappropriate use of potent topical steroids. Burning and stinging were the most frequently reported symptoms, with erythema being the most common sign. They concluded that topical steroid withdrawal is likely a distinct clinical adverse effect of topical corticosteroid misuse. A joint statement from the BAD and National Eczema Society in 2021 acknowledges that patients may develop a new rash after discontinuing topical corticosteroids, and suggesting that this may represent a heterogeneous group of conditions rather than one single entity. The MHRA have issued warnings to patients and healthcare professionals to be judicious in topical steroid prescribing to prevent prolonged use of high-potency topical steroids due to the risk of topical steroid withdrawal. A survey via patient advocacy groups reports a high rate, 79%, of topical steroid withdrawal, higher than other studies. This is probably related to self-reporting and bias in the study, given it was part of a patient advocacy group, but nonetheless highlights that we're probably underdiagnosing and recognising it as clinicians. No consensus diagnostic criteria exist. Topical steroid withdrawal is often interpreted as flaring of underlying atopic dermatitis or contact allergy to topicals. This recent case series, N equals 19, confirmed it mainly affects females, age less than 35, and most frequent symptoms are redness, skin pain, especially burning, sensitivity, flaking, and itch. A high burden of anxiety, depression, and suicidality was noted. Nearly half sought non-conventional treatments, e.g. Chinese medicine, restricted diets, and often paid for expensive overseas dermatology advice. Conventional treatments such as antibiotics, dupilumab, phototherapy, etc. are at an early stage, along with a holistic approach seem to help engagement and improve speed to topical steroid withdrawal resolution. Many experts believe that failure to address the growing discordance between patient concerns and healthcare professionals' response to topical steroid withdrawal alienates dermatology patients, discourages treatment adherence, and increases steroid phobia. Doctors who failed to acknowledge the patient's opinions and instead emphasised the safety of topical corticosteroids was often viewed as dismissive, resulting in deteriorating patient-doctor relationship. Paper 4. Is methotrexate safe for men with an immune-mediated inflammatory disease and an active desire to become a father? Results of the prospective cohort study, IFAME, methotrexate. Perez-Garcia, Annals of the Rheumatic Disease. Why we chose this paper. Some controversy exists around the risk of men fathering children whilst on methotrexate. BAD guidelines suggest advising men to wait at least 3 months since their last dose of methotrexate. In contrast, the British Society for Rheumatology considers paternal exposure to low-dose methotrexate, less than 25 milligrams per week, as compatible with pregnancy. Study aim and design. This was a prospective cohort study conducted in the Netherlands. Men, proved fertile, aged 18 to 55 were recruited. Three groups were used. One, methotrexate starter group, men who were going to initiate on methotrexate. Two, methotrexate chronic group, on this for 1 year plus. On three, healthy controls. Semen samples were obtained. In total, 50 men participated. 20 methotrexate starters, 25 healthy control, and 5 chronic methotrexate patients. The pre-exposure and post-exposure semen parameters of methotrexate starters were not statistically different. Compared with healthy controls, the conventional semen parameters and the sperm DNA fragmentation index of the methotrexate starters were not significantly different. The concentration of intracellular PTH-PG in seminal fluid and spermatozoa was very low. Limitations, is it applicable? This was a well-designed prospective study. A minority of patients had psoriasis. Only one semen sample was taken per visit, and because of the wide known variability of sperm concentration, this ideally should have been 2. What's the take-home message? This study found that the treatment with methotrexate is not associated with testicular toxicity in men, and that the concentration of intracellular methotrexate PG in seminal fluid and spermatozoa was very low. They suggested that methotrexate can be safely started or continued in men diagnosed with immune-mediated inflammatory diseases and with an active wish to become a father. This is in keeping with American and British rheumatology guidelines. Paper 5. Prurigo pigmentosa, Shen et al., Journal of the American Academy of Dermatology. Why we chose this paper. Prurigo pigmentosa is an inflammatory skin disease characterized by a sudden eruption of pruritic erythematous papules in a reticular pattern followed by hyperpigmentation. Little is known about it, and in recent years it has been linked with ketogenic diets. Study aim and design. This was a retrospective notes review study across 3 academic centres in the United States. Demographic and clinical information were extracted. This included treatments trialled. What were the main findings? 30 patients were included, 21 were female, and the average age was 41 years. The majority of patients were white, followed by Asian. 29 patients had BMI greater than 25. All patients presented with erythematous papules coalescing into plaques with a background of reticulated hyperpigmentation with or without scale, and all patients endorsed pruritus. The commonest affected sites were back, 46%, chest, 43%. Of the patients, 40%, 12 out of 30, were on a ketogenic diet prior to the onset of their symptoms. Histopathological findings for prurigo pigmentosa were subtle and non-specific. All patients received treatment. Topical corticosteroids, 12 out of 30, only provided temporary relief, whereas oral antibiotics, doxycycline and minocycline for 11 out of 30 led to complete resolution in all treated patients. Limitations: is it applicable? This is a retrospective notes review study, so interpretation is limited. The study provides useful information on this relatively rare condition. What's the take-home message? This retrospective study highlights some important aspects of prurigo pigmentosa, a link to ketogenic diets, a high BMI in nearly all patients, and a wide age range, 18 to 74 years, and limited efficacy with topical steroids. Tetracyclines were seen to be highly effective in treated patients with a 1 to 2 month course. Paper 6. Suicidal behaviour in psychodermatology patients, identifying characteristics and a new model for referral. Lockwood et al. Skin Health Disease. Why we chose this paper? At St George's, like many NHS trusts, we've struggled to acquire funding for embedded psychological support despite a keen awareness of how prevalent depression and anxiety are amongst our dermatology patients. With lacking specialist support, as dermatologists, we need to know how to detect and manage suicidality. Study aim and design. This was a retrospective notes review of 69 adult patients seen in a psychodermatology clinic in London, which accepts out-of-area referrals, to identify patient characteristics associated with a higher risk of suicidal behaviour. What were the main findings? 23% had active suicidal ideation. Peak age ranges were 25 to 35 and 50 to 69. Characteristics associated with suicidal ideation included having recently moved to the UK, being single, divorced, widowed, being unemployed, and substance abuse. All had psychiatric comorbidity. About half of these with suicidal ideation had primary psychiatric conditions, e.g. dermatitis artefacta, and the rest had primary dermatological conditions, e.g. eczema. Limitations: is it applicable? This was a small sample, observational, retrospective, high-risk group, given that they've been referred to a psychodermatology clinic. What's the take-home message? Authors propose helpful questions, e.g. have things ever been so bad that you've thought that your life is not worth living? If yes, then explore if they've thought about acting on their feelings, active suicidality, and then any plans or protective factors. Authors remind us that men are less likely to volunteer suicidality, but are more likely to complete suicide. Next steps might include contacting their key worker if they have one, and are open to this, or liaison psychiatry, or walking them to A&E, or contacting a friend or relative if they consent. If they did not consent but you've got concerns for their safety, then psychiatric liaison will assess whether their detention under Section 136 of the Mental Health Act is reasonable. It's important for dermatologists to feel confident in approaching this difficult topic and understand how to respond if suicidality is detected. Paper 7. Why Nigeria has declared skin lightening a health emergency. Bokini, BMJ. Nigeria's FDA equivalent has declared a national emergency relating to risks of skin lightening products, including diabetes, hypertension, neuropathy, and hepatic or renal toxicity. Lighter skin apparently translates to improved social and economic prospects, and use of these products may be underpinned by prejudicial beliefs. We're told that nephrologists are noticing an increase in unexplained early-onset renal failure. Dermatologists in Nigeria relay that nearly half of their patients are using or have used lightening products, and that many newer organic products contain high-potency topical steroids and can be marketed at young children. An outright ban may worsen the problem, we're told. Paper 8. John Robert Oppenheimer and the Social Responsibilities of Science, Ball, Lancet. Christopher Nolan's recent film release, Oppenheimer, raises important questions about the social responsibility of science. Recent events together with the spread of social media lead us to question what duties exist towards the general public. The writer asks, should scientific advisers remain silent about policy decisions or political actions likely to be injurious to public health? Would that position suffice when it comes to, say, nuclear weapons or climate change? The answer may not be clear or obvious, but the question should be acknowledged. During the COVID-19 pandemic, Sir Patrick Vallance stated that his duty was to present ministers with the unvarnished facts as far as they were known, and to do all he could to ensure they were understood, but then to accept that the policies that ensured were not his to shape or to critique. As doctors, discussing this grey area is important, and more frank conversations are necessary. Paper 9. Profiling UK Injectable Aesthetic Practitioners, a National Cohort Analysis, Zargaran et al., published ahead of print in Journal of Plastics and Reconstructive Aesthetic Surgery. The United Kingdom UK injectables market has been growing rapidly with an estimated compound annual growth rate of 3.6% and a projected value of £11.7 billion by 2026. The lack of formal, robust regulation has led to the UK government seeking to evaluate methods of regulating the industry. The authors performed a systematic search in 2022 using Google of aesthetic practitioners in the UK. A total of 1,224 independent clinics, comprising 3,667 practitioners, were identified. Doctors formed the majority of practitioners at 32%. Dentists and dental nurses formed 24% and 8% respectively. Of the 1,163 doctors identified, a total of 481 were on the specialist register and 219 were on the GP register. This leaves a total of 463 doctors, 40%, not on the specialist or GP register. A total of 27 specialities were represented in this cohort analysis. Plastic surgery formed the majority of those who were on the specialist register at 37%, and dermatologists came second on 18%. This data shows the wide variety of backgrounds and experiences current practitioners have. This will be an important consideration for the forthcoming consultation to consider the impact of licensing on the various stakeholders.